This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about compassion with Trey Anthony, a guest we're so excited to join us for this special Christmas episode. And Merry Christmas to you if you are listening on the day. Most people don't. What does that say about me that I was checking my download figures whilst the rest of the world were with their family?
That you needed better presents.
And the other voice you hear is my flatmate, Kat. Danielle sadly can't be with us today. She's at a family funeral. We've actually ended up recording this episode on the Tuesday before it goes out. So it's no bad thing that we can get the chance to reflect on a very turbulent few days, which perhaps make our theme even more relevant. So I wanted to go with the theme of compassion because to me, it feels like a kind of Christmassy word. And I looked it up whilst we were researching, and it's not backed up by the internet, so I don't know why I've got that impression, but it's just a word I associate.
But it's probably because it's a concern for the sufferings and misfortunes of others, and at Christmas time you talk about giving and it's about alleviating suffering and all that sort of stuff. Not that that should be a Christmas only theme, it should be there all year round, but especially when you're getting lots of stuff, it's nice to help others at the same time, so it's probably why you think it around Christmas.
So what you're telling me is I'm a good Christian after all.
I'm not making any sort of observation or decision on that, especially not recorded.
Wow. So I guess that's probably is where a lot of it comes from. But in today's episode, we particularly wanted to look at compassion towards ourselves at a time which varies so widely for people. And as we've talked about in previous Christmases, there can be a lot of shame if you are someone that does not enjoy Christmas, or if you find maybe the family elements of it stressful, or you're dealing with seasonal affectiveness disorder. There's so many factors that can make it a stressful time, and the build up and the have I got all the presents? Can I afford all the presents?
Are they the right presents?
Are people just pretending to like the presents that I've got them?
All the food that I've just cooked and spent hours in the kitchen trying to perfect.
Yeah, so this one is even harder because this time, yes, we can go to the shops, but do we feel safe going to the shops? Not all of us. And of course, on Saturday, we had the new announcements that our Christmases would be very different to what we expected with this new strain of the virus. And so it's quite a concerning thing because I think only a few weeks ago, I was thinking this probably isn't wise, the whole lifting the measures, but I really want my Christmas.
But I think that's quite a natural reaction because, you know, it's, a lot of us haven't seen family for well on 9 months in some cases. I mean, personally, I haven't seen my mum since March, and that was only because I had that graduation ceremony. And so I really, really did want to go home for Christmas. But that's now not possible. I've had to reschedule and I'm staying with my friend instead, which is great. And it'll be the first time I've had a Christmas with just friends, and I've always kind of wanted to do that, but not under these circumstances. I wanted it to be my choice. But at the same point, my mum is in quite a low infection rate area at the moment, and I'm not willing to potentially put her in danger and all the people in the local area in danger. Having said that, you know, mental health and seeing family and that connectivity is a big factor for myself and a lot of other people. So it's also about trying to manage all of that. And it's a massive, massive balancing game at the moment. And it feels pretty impossible at times. But yeah, it's just about trying to find the best way for you forward.
And I think there's an immense sense of kind of grief around it, really. You know, we talk so much about grief in terms of losing people, and of course for so many people that is going to be the case. In addition to that, there's the grief of everything else that we're missing.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because I mean, loss, change is loss, and loss is change, and for a lot of people a lot of things have changed this year. We haven't really had time to take a step back and go, okay, let's process this and see where I'm at. And I agree, a lot of people aren't going to be at the Christmas dinner table. I mean, my mum, for the first year, we lost my granddad. thankfully not due to COVID, but it was still very difficult. So this is the first year that my mum doesn't have any parents to go and see. And I really wanted to be here with her for that. But it's, unfortunately, like I said before, it's not possible. But also, a lot of us are going to feel like we've lost a year and not really gained anything by it. And so that can be very difficult to sort of try and move forward with in a positive way as well, especially when next year doesn't look massively different to this year. Although with the vaccine coming in, that's a positive thing and hopefully a way forward for us all.
Yeah, for sure. And that is one positive stat I can give, that as of yesterday, so Monday the 21st, we passed the first 500,000 vaccinations that have taken place in the UK. That is the first half, because the one that's approved at the moment has to have two doses. So that doesn't unfortunately mean 500,000 people have that full protection yet. But I am pleasantly surprised how quickly that's gone out, particularly at this time of year.
They've kind of got the structure in place already because they are used to doing the flu vaccine each year. So some of that structure is already in place. I mean, also we need to give a lot of credit to care workers who are giving up potentially Christmas and other important holiday stuff to be able to vaccinate over that period, as well as all the immense amount of work that I've put in all before.
And even just work on Christmas Day. Yeah. If you're only allowed to see your family now in Christmas Day for much of the UK, then you're giving that up if you're working a shift.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've not really seen much talk about. I know that Leanne Wood, who's a Welsh politician who I am obsessed with, she's campaigning for that in Wales, but there's not been a huge amount of conversation about this. And this is, I think, the position that we keep mentioning, that we're all in very different boats in this. But like you say, hopefully, even with the new strain heading in the right direction, we will just see how much Christmas changes things. But you know what? Looking forward to, I guess, the day. Yeah. You know, that can't be taken away from us, even if what we're doing is vastly different.
And you know, you might be creating new exciting traditions that you can take forward, because I'm staying with my friend, we're having a pyjamas day, which we've always dressed up for our Christmas, so to wear pyjamas all day is going to be very novel to me, but I'm very excited, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And so I guess that comes back to our theme, really, of compassion, that we, particularly with the recent changes over the weekend, have to take this time to be a little bit easier on ourselves. You know, we are not going to get the Christmas we imagined, but that is not our fault. And therefore, there is no logic to beating ourselves up about it or feeling like we've somehow failed. Or there will be a lot of families with a turkey that maybe they can't face eating for maybe just two people. And I think that's perfectly fine. You know, change your plans, but try not to feel guilty about it. And I think our guest this week is a really good example of that, where she's someone who is so inspirational to so many people, having been dubbed the Oprah of Canada for her trailblazing work within TV there. So she fronted and created the first ever TV show that articulated the Black experience within Canada, and has gone on to make so much more that increases diversity all around the many countries she's lived in. And is really an example of someone that on the outside has been so impressive and inspiring to so many people that feel represented by her work, but behind the scenes has had so much turbulence and so many unexpected things, and has had to learn that, okay, I can't seem to control all of this and make my life the linear upward trajectory of comfort that I somehow wanted. But instead, what I can do is be easier on myself when things don't work out or it's out of my control. Particularly, like she talks about the ending of a long-term relationship, sometimes that happens and we're the one left. And so we can turn all the negative feelings around that and the loss that we feel in on ourselves, and the massive mental health impact that can have. So yeah, Trey Anthony, delighted to have her on the show. And as it's a special festive episode, we are also mirroring it on our other podcast, Dating Games. So once you've listened to this, I will have a link in the episode description. So do go listen to that. It'll come out on Friday, so the 26th. Wait, I've messed up here. This episode is going to come out on Christmas Eve. Okay, I take it back. Happy Christmas Eve. The other podcast will be our Christmas Day episode. We'll leave this nonsense in. It's the time of year. I don't know what day it is anymore. So if you're looking for some light-hearted conversation that's still relevant to the times, but doesn't take it too seriously, then head over to Dating Games and by all means start with this episode, but the back catalogue is there for you as well. Thank you for your support through this year. We'll be back next week on Mental with a kind of roundup episode with a previous guest. This week, though, please enjoy this conversation with the brilliant, inspirational Trey Anthony. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. None of us can know what the new year will hold, but one thing you can commit to is a better shave with Harry's. I know only too well how expensive razors can be as someone with a small army of different ones lined up in the bathroom. So was delighted to find out about a brand so committed to value and quality they launched with their own factory and have since won over 20 million customers. So what does Harry's offer that other brands don't? Well, with 5 precision engineered blades, an ergonomically weighted handle, and a rich lather shave gel, you'll get the close and comfortable shave that every ad promises. All that for less than half the price of the nearest 5-blade brand. Support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/mentalhealth. That's harrys.com/mentalhealth. You'll just pay for the shipping for the trial, so there's nothing to lose but a more comfortable face to gain.
Hi, my name is Trey Anthony. I have vivid memories of my Jamaican grandmother talking about various family members and saying, well, you know, don't really bother with her because, you know, she suffers with her nerves. And it wasn't until later that I realized in my life how many women in my family actually had mental health, and we called it suffering with their nerves or saying they were nervous. I also have vivid memories of being a child and my grandmother going into her room for days on top of days and pulling the covers over her head and just muttering under the sheets, I'm so fed up, I'm so fed up. And I know as a family that we just used to say grandma's in one of her moods, and we knew that it was for us to be quiet and to be gentle with her. And my job was always to go in and just give her a small cup of tea on her dresser and leave it there. And my grandmother would be in her room, I would say from 3 to 4 days. And then miraculously, she would just get up and draw the curtains. And it was this fun, loving, warm, very vivacious woman who would appear out of the room. And I definitely know it wasn't until I started writing about my own mental illness that I recognized that my grandmother definitely had some mental illness, which was undiagnosed and something that we never talked about as a family.
Wow. It's really fascinating that, but also so common that within families, mm-hmm. you find all these ways of coding languages rather than actually saying what's going on.
Yes, yes. And I think especially in Caribbean families and Black families, there's this level of shame and this level of coding that we do where it's, I remember it was like, she's nervous as a kitten or her head's not good and all of this. And it was never just saying what it is. You know, I've had aunts, cousins, uncles who have been in mental health facilities, and we never ever named it and said, this is what they have is a mental illness. It was always kind of like, oh, they're stressed out or they're overworked. And we never would call it what it was. And it was just definitely this level of shame.
Mm. And do you think as a young person, you felt that shame? You may not have known what was actually going on, but did you feel that people were tiptoeing around a subject?
Definitely. I knew there was something that I wasn't quite understanding, especially as a child. And I couldn't quite name it of what it was. But I knew there was something that we weren't saying. And I knew enough that I wasn't bold enough to ask it. I knew that it would be shut down. So I never questioned it or asked about it. but I definitely know now as an adult, there were several people in my family who had mental illness and we didn't discuss it.
It's hard to hear. And yet at the same time, you were supporting each other. You were still finding ways to look out for your grandmother. The household was still addressing these issues up to a point, but it's almost like if we name it, then we have to admit there's a problem. And instead, we'll just try and get along with it and hope that it disappears in silence, which we know mental health, that's not how it works. But it's interesting how you see that in all different cultures. You know, it's like the British stiff upper lip mentality is an equivalent. Yes. Or, you know, Irish people have phrases like someone's a bit touched, as in they've got mental illness. So it's like wherever you go, there's different versions of this same stigma.
That is funny because in Jamaican culture, we also say touched as well. She's a little touched. So it's funny that when you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I know that one too. Yeah,
there's a lot of crossover. And actually, that's probably something you've seen a lot of because you've lived in a lot of places. You started off in Hackney, right?
Yes.
Grew up in London before moving over to Canada, and now you're in the States, in Florida. So do you see that kind of similarity wherever you are as well?
Definitely. I've seen it so much. I think especially when I moved from Toronto to Atlanta in the South, I saw a very coded language around people saying, bring your troubles to God or pray about it instead of just naming. And so that was something that I saw more so when I was living in the South and in Atlanta, where people would not address anything around mental health or mental illness, but to say, oh, you know, she's going through it, and encouraging whoever's going through it to pray about it.
Mm. And it's a really tricky thing in religious communities to challenge that because there's already that established hierarchy of religious elders that you've got to look up to. So to say something different to them is really challenging. And yet I often see that the ironies of we don't have that battle with physical illness. You know, someone doesn't break a bone and then get told to go to church. You know, there's we never even have to have that conversation. There was times when that was the case, but the way society has evolved, and yet mental illness is still being left in that place, that can feel easier than facing up to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I just, I don't know what it, I feel though, the more people talk about it and name it for themselves and be open about it, it will allow more people to actually know they're not alone. And it will allow more people to be much more open and much more vulnerable about their own struggles and issues around mental illness. And that is something that I have found, that the more open I have become now around naming my own depression for myself and sharing that with people, I can't tell you how many people now have emailed me or sent me a letter or, you know, Instagrammed me to say, oh, thank you, me too, you know? And so I think it's about actually creating the dialogue and having the conversation and releasing the stigma around it.
That's brilliant. And that's a very compassionate way of looking at it, to link to today's theme, because it can be difficult bridging these gaps between different communities and different perspectives. But as much as we can, we try and find a united way to come together on, it doesn't matter what background you're from, we all experience mental health stigma to some extent. And therefore, there has to be some sort of shared answer. So particularly at a time, you know, this episode going out around Christmas, understandably, many people are looking to their faith more than they normally would, perhaps. But that doesn't have to be the only solution. In the same way, other things that you would go to your religious community for, like grieving, which a lot of people are doing this year particularly intensely. Yes, you would pray about it, but you would also speak to other people you know through that community, or you would speak to a religious elder.
Yeah, for sure.
And do you find then, with coming from that background and the way your family talked about or didn't really about mental health, were you then reluctant to name it for yourself?
Well, it was so funny, Bobby. I did not know. And I was writing a book, my book, Black Girl in Love. and I was interviewing a psychiatrist about mental illness and anxiety and depression amongst Black women. And as I was interviewing her, she said this. She said, a lot of times when Black women have depression, we don't know that we're depressed because we're so used to getting up and just going through our daily routines. And she said, and then there's this whole thing of just like in the community around being strong. And then she said, and so usually by the time a Black woman goes to seek treatment around her mental health, her symptoms are usually 3 times worse than her white counterparts. And then she started listing all of the signs of depression, right? And if there was a checklist of 10 things that she said, as I was recording them, I was like, oh, I have that. I have that. Oh, I have that. And I got off the phone with her and I burst out crying. And just to give you some context, at this point in my life, I had just ended a 5-year relationship. I didn't end it. I was abruptly dumped, right? So let me just put that in because I want to make myself sound good about I ended. No, I was dumped. I had a brand new baby that I had just adopted who was less than 2 weeks old. When my partner ended the relationship, I had less than 2 weeks to move out of our apartment. So I was practically homeless, living back at home with my mom and sister. And I was also now mothering in a pandemic. And so when I finally sought help after interviewing that psychiatrist and I went to a service and I spoke to a therapist, the therapist said to me, and I will always remember this, he said, just one of these things would cause stress. He said, you are doing all of these things. He goes, you are a new mother. You are moving. You're displaced. You're ending a relationship and you're in a pandemic. And you thought you could handle this by yourself? And he said, did you not know that you were depressed? And I said, I knew something was happening. And I knew that I was crying uncontrollably. I knew I felt like I was in this kind of fog and it was taking me a while to catch up with thoughts in my head. I knew that I was sleeping a lot. I knew that everything felt really heavy and I could barely just do the minimum. But I said, I kept saying to myself, you can get through this. And when he said to me, you are severely depressed, I said to him, oh, okay, yeah. I'll take some medication. I said, just put me on it for a couple of weeks and I'll be fine. And he said to me, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're going to be on this medication for at least a year, if not more. He said, you are severely depressed. I have never seen depression like this. And it was that's when it really hit me. And even after he said this to me, when the medication arrived in my home, it came in the mail. I looked at it on the counter and for 5 days, I refused to take it because of the stigma, my own shame around it. I kept saying, I don't want to be quote unquote crazy. I don't want people to think that I can't handle my life. And I was like, my mother and grandmother have gone through way worse and I've never seen them pop a pill. And it took me at least 5 days before I actually started taking the medication. And then within 3 weeks, I noticed a huge, dramatic difference. And I will always remember this conversation. At one point, I said to my mother, do you know that I'm depressed, right? And my mother goes, of course, everybody knows you're depressed. Right? I was like, so how nobody told me this? And she goes, well, I just knew you would get over it. Wow. My whole family said they knew I was depressed. And no one ever said those words to me. Like, you might need to get some help around that. Or what are you doing around it? It was just like, she'll figure it out and she'll get over it. And this wasn't something that I could figure out by myself. It just wasn't. And I tried, like before I started taking the medication, I did yoga, I did running, I did journaling, I did all of those things. And I still, in my mind, I kept saying, I will shake this, I can handle this, I can do this. And even once I started taking the medication, I never told anybody for at least 3 or 4 months because I had so much shame.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. It's very honest, and that really speaks to the stigma so many people feel with medication. That's something that should feel like an answer and a life draft for people, so often they can get in their own way because of what's floating in the air, that stigma that we're around. And even hearing you describe it, I couldn't help but wonder two things. First of all, that's kind of an answer perhaps on why you'd not known family members take medication, because they had that mentality. You know, that mentality they were putting on you about you'll get through it, no doubt was exactly the way they saw themselves. And like you say, Black women in particular are encouraged to do that, you know, to be strong, to hold up their communities, to be bastions of their children and their families, and really keep people together. And to admit that you need help might somehow compromise your ability to be the thing you're expected to be. And that is massive. And then the other thing I couldn't help but think was with you saying about going those months and not telling anyone. You may well have been the other side of that with family members.
Yes, definitely. Because there was so much shame. And I will tell you, Bobby, I didn't start telling people until one morning. My son got up earlier than usual. And it was about, he usually gets up about 6:30 in the morning. And this time he got up, it was about 4:30 in the morning. I went to the kitchen to get him a bottle. And like we do when your child doesn't sleep and you are like exhausted, I turned on my phone and I started flipping through Facebook, right? As I was feeding him. And as I was feeding him, I saw that one of my friends was on a Facebook Live. And I was like, oh, this is strange that they're on this Facebook Live at 4:30 in the morning. So I clicked on it. And when I clicked on the Facebook Live, I was the only one in the room with my friend. And I realized as I was watching, my friend was distraught. They were crying. They were just babbling. And I realized what I was witnessing was someone who was basically doing a suicidal goodbye to friends and family.
Wow.
And they were there on this Facebook Live going, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to kill myself. And I want to say goodbye to him. And I started to panic, of course, right? And so I started typing frantically going, don't do this. Don't do this. You're not alone. And they abruptly got off the Facebook Live. And then I, of course, was just like, what the hell should I do? And so I called some of our closest friends that we had mutually. And then I called the police. And thank God they were able to get to them in time. And they were placed in a psychiatric hospital for a few days. And when I eventually spoke with them, she said, you know, thank God that you saved my life and thank you. And they said, I had stopped taking my medication because I didn't want people to know that I was depressed and I thought I was okay. And then I turned to them and I said, oh, I'm on antidepressants too. And they were like, what? You? But you seem to have it all together. Like you're at the top of your game. And I said, yeah, I'm at the top of my game. I seem to have it all together, but I'm also severely depressed. And that was the catalyst for me to start to tell people, because I realized there were so many of us, especially in the Black community, who thought we were alone or decided not to take our medication. And this was after I think I had been taking the medication for about 3 months. And that was when I decided to start telling people, because I said, me being open about being on medication, I think can truly save lives. And it was as I started to tell people, then I had various friends within my own circle. There was one friend who I thought who was this successful, amazing, brilliant woman, ran her own business, did all of these things. And she said to me, Trey, I have attempted suicide twice. And I finally got on medication because I could not do this anymore. And as I became more vulnerable, I started to hear about people who had suicide attempts, people who have been on medication now and was able to manage their depression, people who talked about anxiety. And it was, for me, a freeing experience. And I realized that I needed to be open and transparent about this because it allowed others to be open and transparent. And it also gave me a level of compassion, not just for others, but a level of compassion for myself. And I felt that was truly needed, that I needed to let go of this strong woman image of myself and say, you know what? You might need some help and some support around managing your life. This is a lot that you're going through. This is not, it's far from ideal circumstances. And it doesn't make you weak. It just means you're a person who needs support, compassion, and love.
Wow, that's massive. And also, I'd add to that, it doesn't mean you're not strong either.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You know,
and this comes up time and time again with the podcast, that people feel these similar feelings, and at the same time, they feel they're on their own with it because people aren't speaking up. So they're all in their silos of suffering, thinking they're the only one and not knowing and thinking these same thoughts.
Yes.
And actually, you know, it's the illness. And the more I interview people that have gone through mental illness, the more even my own perception switches, that I'm almost the other way around now. That many of the strongest people I've ever met are the people that have had the worst experiences with mental illness. And that is not a coincidence. That's part of why, because they've survived that. And I think you learn from it and you build up a resilience and an ability to get through.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's something that I think isn't really talked about, right? We talk about it gets easier, but we don't talk as much about you get better at handling it.
Mm-hmm. And also recognizing it. For me, I know a lot of my symptoms also get much more severe around when I get my period. And for many years, I used to say to people, and all my partners used to always talk about it and say, Trey's in her slump. And it would happen a week before I got my period. I would go into this really kind of dark place and I would be very sensitive. I would really come down really hard on myself. And there was kind of like this little voice in my head would be like, oh, you're not managing your life. You should have been here. You should have done this. You should have gotten that. And I would call it my slump. And it wasn't until I started taking, and this was for years of my life. It's not just something that just happened. For many years, everybody around me would be like, oh, she's in her slump. And I would call it my slump as well. And then as soon as it passed, then I was great. And then the funny thing, what used to also happen as a creative, I found when I was in that place, I wrote some of the best shit that I've ever written, right? And so I used to kind of embrace it and be like, okay, in my slump, I'm able to write, I'm able to be more creative, blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't until I started taking medication that I realized this actually isn't something that you needed to be going through once a month. It does not make you weak to be kind of like, this actually isn't normal for you to feel like this and be battling these dark thoughts every month. But it was something that I had just gotten used to, and everyone around me actually played into it as well. No one ever said to me, you know what, maybe you should go to a doctor about it. It was just kind of like, she's in her slump. And that's what we called it and labeled it.
Yeah. And so that became the coded language for you then?
Yes. And it became my quote unquote excuse. Like I would say to people, well, you know, I'm in my slump right now. I can't, this feels too much for me right now. I'm in my slump. And that's what I would say. Mm. Right. And everyone around me was like, oh, she's doing her slump.
And that's a danger, right, that it can be so normalized that actually breaking through the stigma can be such a solution in itself sometimes, because when you name things for what they are, when you call it depression, you can notice very quickly people's attitudes change. But there can be this kind of dangerous, particularly for creatives, actually, romanticizing of suffering.
Yeah.
That you're meant to be a struggling artist, which begs the question, does that mean art shouldn't be financed properly? Why is it this area that we find so much joy in, you know, particularly in the pandemic? What are we doing more of to cope with it? Watching TV, watching movies, watching the plays that are streamed to us, catching up on comedy specials, all of these things that help lift our mood. And then so often the people don't get the financial support to be comfortable. And it can be easier to think this is a me problem and I've got to struggle and this is part of the process and I'm meant to be a struggling artist, than it is to think the whole system's wrong. Artists should be getting better support. Why is it we've got an internship for everything else, but You don't get paid to do a creative internship. You do for going and working in a bank.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And I do think, like you said, we do romanticize this moodiness, I think, with artists as well. Like when you call it like your mood and, oh, you know, one of my exes who I was with for 10 years said, I just always thought you were moody and you're moody because you're creative. And so she goes, I never ever thought it was depression. I would be just like, Trey's moody. She's a moody artist, right? And I was like, oh, okay, right. And I was with her for 10 years. And she just said, it just became something that I knew that this is what you did. Like you went into this kind of dark place, but this was also the time where you would write furiously, you know? So it's, yeah.
And it's so difficult to break out of that when it's such a strong perception that other people have of you, and one that maybe to a degree you wanted to go along with, to think there's another reason that's not depression.
Yes, exactly. And I never, ever thought I was depressed. I will tell you that. It never crossed my mind at any time. And it wasn't until, like I said, I was interviewing that psychiatrist and she was naming all of the signs of depression. And I was like, oh, dear God. Right. So, yeah, I never thought it. I never, ever said, oh, this is me and I'm depressed. No.
And luckily you did find that out, and then you go on the medication, you notice a big shift. Was there a process of almost like a forgiveness for not being able to always cope?
There definitely was really this idea of giving myself permission to grieve, giving myself permission to let things go, and giving myself permission to be able to cry about things and name it and say, I'm actually hurt. A relationship that I had invested a lot of time and energy just kind of blew up in my face. I didn't see it coming. I felt betrayed. And it was giving myself permission to find that safe space within my own life where I could fall apart, but also know that I was safe to do so, that I didn't have to pretend that I wasn't hurting. I didn't have to pretend that I wasn't feeling it. And I think that's what people think, is that when you take this medication that it makes you numb and you don't feel anything. What it did for me was actually give me permission to say, you are going through something. You are grieving. This is a loss. You are also a new mother and you are trying to figure this all out, and all of your support systems have fallen out of place. And so it's okay for you to just say, right now, I'm not feeling strong. Right now, I actually need to be kind and gentle with myself. So it came down to, yes, taking medication, but it also came down to some days I would take a bath when I usually would have this 5-minute quick shower. It came down to allowing myself to sleep sometimes and not feel guilty about it, and journaling and calling friends and saying, today I'm actually having a really bad day. I'm grieving the demise of this relationship. I'm grieving the demise of the life that I thought I should have had. And I don't think I would have been able to name those things or even write about those things in the book if I did not label and know that what I am is a person who has depression. I think I would have skirted around it. I would have really forced myself to get up and go and be strong, quote unquote strong, and, you know, work through it and whatever. And to be able to name this, it really made me just get soft with myself, because I think in general, I can be really critical, highly critical of myself, which has worked for me in my success of being really ambitious and very driven, but it never gave me a time to be able to say, you need to rest, you need to cry, you need to grieve, you need to slow down. You can't do it all at once, and you don't need to do it all at once. That was something that I think only this year, in all my years of life, I gave myself permission to say, you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to put on this mask of you got this. And it was the first time I said to friends and family, I ain't got it. I'm actually falling fucking apart. Sorry. I'm actually falling apart. Right. And it was the first time I actually allowed myself to do that. But I think for many years, I didn't think that I would be able to fall apart and get back up.
And what I've noticed now, I allow myself days to fall apart, and I have the belief and faith that the next day I will get up. And maybe I might fall apart again 2 days from now, but I still keep getting up. And for me, for the longest time, I felt that if I ever fell apart, never be able to put myself back together. And I held it all in. And I wanted to be this quote-unquote strong, capable, driven, got her shit together woman. And that's what I presented to the whole world. And that's what I presented to myself.
Yeah. And in that way, you can start to feel almost like it's some self-betrayal.
Yeah.
When you can't meet that machine-like standard you've set for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's something with my depression I've definitely had to revisit as a skill during the pandemic. That there are days where there's too much going on, the news is too depressing. And, you know, to be honest, I'm sort of more surprised at this point if somebody's got through this year and hasn't struggled with their mental health at some point. I kind of wonder what they're hiding, because of course we would. And so we've got to have that compassion for ourselves that this is a challenging time. And sometimes it is. Sometimes you know what's going on and why you're struggling more. And sometimes you don't. But either way, there are days where I have to take a morning off, take a day off, finish work early, because I'm hitting a wall.
Yeah.
And the key thing is not just making that action, but how you treat yourself about it. So if I take a morning off and then despise myself for it, and think in my head, oh, you should be better than this. You've worked on your mental health too much to be struggling in this way, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're just making excuses. Everyone else is handling it, much of which obviously isn't true. You don't actually change anything, because then what? I start work later and I'm feeling just as bad because I'm piling on myself. And instead, by taking a bit of a break and thinking, okay, I'm going to take this morning. I'm going to do what I need to in terms of self-care. In terms of sometimes I need to distract myself, sometimes I need to go on a walk, whatever it is, I try out my toolkit. And then I come in to the afternoon and getting back on what I need to do a lot more refreshed than stewing and falling into self-hatred that only makes depression worse.
Definitely. I love what you said about your toolkit. That has been something for me that I have created in my life to be like, okay, every single morning without fail, you know, I walk or I jog for an hour. I really cut down on watching the news. I do not watch the news at all. Even things around on TV, like TV shows, there are certain things that I no longer participate in and watch, because I realize that I'm really hypersensitive to things. And so one of my favorite things now to do is when I'm driving in the car, sometimes I'll listen to a self-help book, or I will go to Pandora and I put in the comedy channel and I'll listen to, you know, a Chris Rock or a Dave Chappelle special or something, like something that I know can lift my spirits, right? I have this thing where I say to myself, 3 times a week, you actually have to do a FaceTime call with a friend, and you have to have that intimacy and that contact. And I try my best to get as much sleep as I can as a new mom. That's really important. And just being really aware and sometimes just saying it aloud. Today feels like a hard day for me. What are you going to do? And being able to be without judgment around that, right? And not thinking that I have to, you know, be on this grind culture at all times of, you know, so I can have something wonderful and fantastic to post on Instagram and Facebook, right? Sometimes it's just like, you know what? This is it. This is as good as it damn well gets.
Great. And it's lovely to see how you've become an example in doing that, that even still with all this you've got going on, and as honest as you are with it, people could still look at your career and all you've achieved and think, she's got it all together. Whatever else has happened, your work output has been so brilliant that people could, of course, think that. But by speaking up, you're that example that actually it's not just the people that seem to be struggling that need the support. Actually, a lot of the role models and the people you look up to, as I know so many people do to you, they still need the support too. There is not some level of person where you are a immovable object and you just exist and nothing can change your environment and how you feel.
It is so true. I saw this meme lately and it said, check on the strong one. And I think we need to really check on the quote unquote strong ones in our lives, because a lot of times the strong ones are struggling. And I've been labeled one of those strong ones, or, you know, the person who seems to have it all together. And yet there were many a time, you know, even this week, where I, you know, I pulled up to the McDonald's and ate my way through, like, you know, a Big Mac and fries, and cried in my car by myself. But I had to name that and say, okay, what is this about? And if you're going to do this tomorrow, then you know you need to be getting some kind of support. You know, and there has been many a days where, before I started taking medication, where the darkness just felt so much, you know, and I just felt like everybody wanted me to put on this charade of happiness, and I just couldn't anymore. And so I really do think it's really important for us as a community and as people to really check in with people who we think has it all together or can handle it. Because there's a lot of us who are falling apart privately and thinking that we have to put on this charade for you. And I no longer want to participate in it anymore. And that is something that has become very freeing for me in this book, to say, I can no longer do this act for you, my family, and even for myself. There are days where I really need someone to say, I got your back. I got you. You know, and one of the things that really stood out for me while I was going through this is I remember every single day when I was crying about the demise of my relationship and my whole life blowing up, I said to one of my friends, I said, well, next week I'm done. I'm done crying and I'm finished.
Well, I've right? made and those said, promises.
Yeah, right. And I said that, like, I actually gave myself a timeline for this grief. And my friend said to me, you know what, Trey, I don't think you can put a timeline on this. And she said, and I think you should just give yourself permission to cry whenever you want to. You really may need to cry about this. Like, what has happened to you has been shitty. Like, this isn't something where anybody's expecting you to pull the shit together. But I had put that kind of limitation and timeline on myself, and that who I am in general. And I had to really shift that thinking for myself. You know, even just recently, I fell apart this week and I was like, oh my God, for God's sake, it's been nearly a year and you're still crying over this. And I was like, you have spent 5 years of your life with someone. It's okay to have a day where you cry about them again, you know, and that has been something that I don't think in the past I've ever allowed myself to feel things. I would either numb it with food, I would numb it with work, I would numb it with sex, you name it, whatever it is. And this is the first time I've really sat in my feelings and allowed myself to feel every single emotion and be able to comfort myself in that.
I love that. And have you found in building that compassion for yourself, you're then more automatically doing it with other people?
Definitely. Because I think it allows you, once you start stripping away at all of the layers that you have for yourself, you also realize that a lot of us are walking around with this armor, you know, and I've even felt it even with my own mother, around being much more compassionate, not just seeing her as my mother and saying, oh, well, you did this or you should have done that, but to be like, she's human. She has her bad days. She has her good days. I've been really gentle with quote unquote friends who I thought are the strong ones. Sometimes now I leave them little messages and I say, hey, you know what? Something just told me to check in with you. How are you doing? What's going on with you? And just really giving people the space to be human. Because I think especially in this culture of Instagram and Facebook and social media and TikTok, we're all on this kind of like mini show of like, look how great I am. Look how wonderful I am. And I'm like, hey, man, like sometimes you got to say to people, I don't need like the song and dance. I just want to really know what's going on with you. And I have been guilty myself of putting on the song and dance time and time again for others. Like I'm an entertainer. So that's what I do. And yet I had to say to myself, today, you don't have to entertain anybody.
Right. That's so great to hear. And you've mentioned the book already. So if people want to get that, could you tell them a little bit about it?
Yeah, the book is called A Black Girl in Love with Herself. And I say it's for any woman who has found herself crying on the bathroom floor alone, thinking that this isn't where my life was supposed to be. It's how to get back up off the floor and really find that love for yourself and the compassion and the tools and identifying that. And especially for Black women, it's such an important resource to be able to really demystify all of the stereotypes we have of being strong and being capable. And also around just talking about mental health and how we find that. And also around, you cannot give over the job to someone to love you. You just can't, especially if you're not loving yourself properly. And it took me many years to figure that out. So that's what this book is about.
Would recommend. And when is that out?
My book comes out January 5th, but you can pre-order the book. And I am strongly encouraging people to pre-order the book. You can order it from Amazon, or you could go to my website, treyanthony.com, or you could support your local booksellers as well. So please pre-order the book and, you know, buy them for Christmas gifts. I keep telling people New Year's gifts, you name it. It really is a life-changing book. So many people have told me that.
Brilliant. All right. So I will include some links for that in the episode description. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such an important show, and the work you're doing is amazing. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.